This is PCJ Radio International.
On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is Media Network Plus.
Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to the program. Being an investigative journalist is not exactly the easiest thing. It's a lot more difficult than being, let's say, just a regular journalist. An investigative journalist can spend sometimes a month, even longer, working on a story. Our guest today is Kate McClemond. She has won numerous awards for her groundbreaking reporting on business, organized crime, and corruption, also getting herself into some sticky situations along the way. She speaks next to our good friend Richard Ady, whose first question is, why do you enjoy doing this?
Well, apart from being fun. Look, in fact, investigative journalism is really no different to normal journalism. The principles are just the same. The ethical considerations are just the same. It just requires a little bit more patience and more ferreting. I think it's the ferreting that perhaps separates it out from everyday journalism.
Bit more. How much more?
A lot more.
Not bit more at all.
No, well, it's that thing where you might make 100 calls for an investigation that you're working on, and of those 100, only 10 might be worthwhile. But you have to put in the hard work. And there are lots of rebuffs. You know, you might start off doing something that you think looks great, but down the track you realise that either you can't prove it, it's too defamatory, you are just not going to get over the line. So there are disappointments along the way.
So you know it going in, and yet it doesn't stop you. That must be, I suppose I want to drill down into the skills and characteristics. One of the characteristics must be that you're optimistic and resilient.
Completely optimistic. I always think that there's going to be something fabulous there, and often when I, you know, work with other people, oh, no, no. And I said, no, come on, come on. It's going to get there. It's going to get there. And the good thing about print is that you can nearly always get something in a story. You might not have the brilliant result that you were hoping for, but often you have enough to do a story or a series of stories. So it's never wasted. And also, I'm known in the offices as the queen of the files. So I have alphabetical files on everything.
What, do you have meters of them?
Meters of them. In fact, when anyone leaves, the first thing I do is look left, look right. Is their cupboard empty? Yes.
Right.
So I colonise with my files.
Right. So your files have grown to move throughout the office.
Oh, yes. And I, the other thing that I am lucky in is that I have a very good memory for scraps of information. So if someone will come to me and say, do you know anything about Mr. X? I'll go, Mr. X, ha-ha, come with me. So over to the files we go, and there will be something. Not always. I have to say, with the electronic storing of things, it does make it so much easier to search your, you know, your computer when you can just type in a name and up they pop.
One of the things you are renowned for is getting people to talk, and sometimes getting people to talk when it's not really in their interest to talk, Kate. How do you do that?
Look, I think it's a natural curiosity, and also I'm quite polite. I love talking to people. I'm interested in hearing what they say. And also, you know, I have human compassion. You know, sometimes I will say to people, look, you do realise this might be not good for you. It might not be something that you will desire. I always think it's best to often warn people, especially people who aren't experienced in dealing with the media. If you ring up, you know, somebody who's been a director of a small company, apart from when you say it's Kate McClymont and you just hear this, you think, look, it's all right, it's all right. I'm only asking you about X, Y, Z. You know, you must try to, talk to people on a human level, not to be always blustering and, you know, hard-hitting. You can be. I can be very hard when I need to be, especially with politicians, when you know that they are lying to you. And I just say, look, what you are saying is not true. And it's interesting the reactions that you get, because I think everyone is the same. I remember once Paul Keating ringing up to abuse me, and I just thought, I'm not putting up with this. So I said, look, if you could read, I said, which I sincerely doubt you can, you would see that in this story I wrote blah, blah, blah. And I just think treat everyone like as you would like to be treated and treat everyone equally.
I want to get into the, I suppose, the genesis of how stories happen. But let's start with something bigger, because you've done so many great stories. Which one is the one you're proudest of?
A former partner of the now-defunct personal injury law firm Keddies has spoken for the first time about the overcharging scandal that engulfed the firm. The New South Wales-based company became infamous for its controversial billing. The firm is facing more than 70 separate court cases over allegations it overcharged former clients. In one case, a client claims he was charged $10,000 for photocopying.
Look, one of the ones I was really proud of was one that I did with my former colleague, Jenny Cook, on Keddies, the law firm. Mm. That actually took weeks, but we were able to reveal a systematic, basically shortchanging of clients. And these are poor, injured clients who spoke little English. And as a result of our work, the law was changed. Also, Keddies is no more. The three partners of Keddies, they're all bankrupted. Some of them have been struck off. So I think that was, you know, one of those ones you're not up to, you know, a win for the good guys. And I don't mean by that journalists. I mean we're doing it on behalf of other people. You know, I often think that our job is giving a voice to the voiceless. So to see those clients get their money back, that the law was changed, you do feel like, you know, look, that was something really worthwhile. And of course, for me, the Eddie Obeid saga has been one of the longest running continual investigations of my life. I think my first investigative piece on Eddie Obeid ran in the year 2000. Mm. And throughout that time, apart from in 2006, my colleague Ann Davies and I were sued successfully by Eddie Obeid, and I have
for
to say
defamation, wasn't
that was
it?
For defamation, and Eddie Obeid won.
Mm.
And that was, I think, the lowest point of my journalistic career. I felt devastated. I felt like a failure. I felt that people would look at me and think, oh, you know, that person's not very good. You know, Eddie Obeid has sued her and won. And that lasted for about a year, just in relation to my Obeid coverage.
So did you kind of leave him alone for a bit?
Yes. Hmm. Because you sort of feel that if you do write more stories, people will look at it as payback or vengeful, or that you haven't taken the umpire's decision. And then you think, no, if a story deserves to be told and there is something there, then it's time to get back on the horse, really. Time to dust yourself off, pick yourself up, and get back on the trail.
If we talk about, carefully, obviously, if we talk about Mr. Obeid and ICAC, and the ICAC inquiry has almost certainly been precipitated by the reporting you did, especially with Linton Besser as well.
Yes, and can I also say my colleague Ann Davies, and also some really fantastic work from the reporters at the Australian Financial Review.
But was there a starting point? Was there a phone call, or was this part of the continued investigation of Mr. Obeid? What was it?
I saw in the court lists that Moses Obeid and his company Streetscape were being sued by the City of Sydney Council. So I went along to that court case. And in fact, it was that court case that provided a crack in the door to the Obeid empire, because Mr. Obeid, this is Moses Obeid, was being prosecuted for not paying royalties he owed to the council. And they're over multifunction poles you'll see along the streets of, you know, mainly in Sydney. They're large poles that have banners on them. Mm. They have lights, banners, traffic lights.
And yes. You really notice them when there's a special occasion.
Exactly. Yeah. So they had the license to produce these poles in Australia. They did not have the overseas licences, except for, you know, one or two special circumstances. So what happened was that the council noticed that they were producing these poles all throughout the Middle East. And in fact, they owed the council some $12 million in licensing fees. So that was quite a protracted court case. But the nub of it for me was that when Moses Obeid said he couldn't pay, he produced financial statements which showed that his income was $100,000 a year, his wife was $80,000, the home wasn't in his name, etc., etc. These were tendered as exhibits, and there were other, his accountants tendered material as well. So I put in to look at these documents, and the Obeids objected. So I had to represent myself in court before the Supreme Court, saying that, you know, in the principle of open justice, it was important that public exhibits that had been tendered should be freely available. What I got was extraordinary, because there were in the accounts monies going to, for example, the cafes down at Circular Quay. Mm. Now, for years, we had been of the belief that the Obeids secretly owned a string of cafes at Circular Quay, but questions put to the proprietors always said no, even though we knew that they were relatives of the Obeids. There was also money going to some of the very people who had won coal licences from Ian MacDonald.
So that was... It was like a Pandora's box.
It was like a Pandora's box. So finally, the links that had been missing for us were there in financial documents relating to, of all things, a poll case.
So from the Obeid point of view, the tendering of those documents on Moses Obeid's behalf to prove he couldn't pay has turned into a massive strategic blunder.
Well, yes. And it was fascinating because Justice Peter Young, you know, in the Supreme Court, actually said that looking at these documents reminded him of a chapter from William Thackeray's Vanity Fair, which was How to Live Well on Nothing a Year.
Yes.
Because it turned out that Moses Obeid and his wife lived in a $4.25 million house in, I think, what Justice Young described as a most superior suburb, that being Vaucluse. They also drove his and her Range Rovers. I think that their outgoings for the year were about $800,000. Their mortgage payments were something like $240,000, and yet their combined incomes were $180,000. How was all this possible?
Lucky at the track.
Lucky at the track. But as it turned out, there were a series of Obeid trusts, and through these trusts were flowing millions and millions of dollars. Where did these millions of dollars come from? Their success at the coal mining, getting coal mining licensed.
So did you get this, when you got the documents, straight away, did you know?
Yes,
this was
absolutely.
It. This, yes. This is going to crack the whole thing.
Well, not that this is going to crack the, not, look, you sort of could sense that, but it was just seeing these names, you thought, oh my goodness, here it is. Here is, you know, the golden arc.
So did you go and make copies and put them somewhere else and things like that, or?
No, I just photocopied them, ran up a little bit of a bill for the Herald, and then, you know, ran back to work saying, hallelujah.
So how often does it come down to the document? Because the document's always, if X tells Y about Z, whether it's literally a bit of paper or an email, then you have got something, haven't you?
Yes. Look, when you do a story, in the back of your mind is always, how am I going to prove this in court? So getting anything in documentary form, of course, is always a bonanza. If you don't get it in documentary form, you have to weigh up your sources, whether they would be credible in a witness box, whether they would be prepared to go in a witness box. You know, there have been occasions when I've had neither of those. When I got the story about Michael Williamson and Craig Thompson of the Health Services Union having American Express cards provided to them by a major contractor to the union, I went into the Herald, I explained the story, And they said, no documents. And I said, I'm telling you, I've got the source. Who is the source? I said, I can't tell you. It's a good source.
Is this the editor or is this the lawyer?
Well, this was initially the editor. Then there was a meeting with the editor-in-chief, two lawyers, the managing editor, and me.
Right.
And I had to convince
them. They were all on one side of the table, yes. And you were on the other one.
It was like doing an audition for something. So I gave, you know, what was a fairly impassioned speech, and I said, look, I'm just telling you, you have to trust me on this. And Peter Frey, who was the editor-in-chief at the time, said, oh, I can see a $200,000 lawsuit. And it was Amanda Wilson, who was the editor at the time, you know, looked at me, looked down, and she said, right, we're going with it. I believe you. We're going to go with it. And that was trust. It was, I think, if you have enough runs on the board.
Yeah, a track record.
Yeah, it's a track record.
I went in and said, look, I've got this yarn.
Maybe. Oh, Richard, I don't know. You could be fairly persuasive.
Have there been moments when you have been sufficiently annoying to people of power that you have been threatened?
Threatened? Look, I can remember once ringing Eddie Obeid for a comment about a certain story, and he just lost the plot and said, I will go for you. I will go for your jugular. You write one word of that story and I will go for you. Now, I take that as being something said in the heat of the moment. I don't literally think that the Obeids would go for my jugular. Having said that, I did find it quite disconcerting when earlier this year, a private investigator rang me and said, look, I actually think you should know this, but Moses Obeid came to me to hire me to follow you, to try to find something in your life that they could use to blackmail you. And at first I laughed. I just thought, oh, my God, my life they would find so boring. work home, play bridge, work home. And then I felt really annoyed. So, and I just thought, well, okay, I must be doing my job well if that's what they were prepared to do.
So you've never felt, not particularly in that instance, but at any instance, you've never felt intimidated or thought, actually, I might stop?
No.
Because there have been times when you've had to move, you've hired security, haven't you?
Both of those. And in the wake of the murder of Sydney businessman Michael McGirt back in 2009, within several days of his murder and writing about that story, I received a death threat delivered to my house, which I took to the police.
What was it? A piece of paper?
It was a piece of paper.
Not a horse's head?
No. No, sadly, not a horse's head. It was a piece of paper, and it basically had a reference to a .303 rifle, and if I kept going, then maybe I would find out what a .303 rifle could do. But people do that because they want you to stop what you are doing. I think it would be really bad for business if they actually carried it out. So, no, look, I'm optimistic, and it's not nice, and I worry about my family. I don't worry about myself so much, but I do sometimes worry about possibly putting them in danger.
Michael McGurk was shot in the head as he got out of his car in front of his Cremorne home last night. His 9-year-old son saw the shooting and ran inside screaming to his mother. Last week, McGurk called a journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald and told her a hitman had been ordered to kill him. His mother-in-law, Noreen MacDonald, says she...
There have been some remarkable sort of scenes. One day your life's going to be filmed or made into a kind of movie, Kate, I think. But when Michael McGurk was killed, the really amazing thing was that a week before he was killed, he told you he thought he was going to be killed.
Yes, look, and I feel really bad about that to this day, because I had met Michael McGurk a couple of times. My then colleague Vander Carson and I had lunch with him, and he was in the middle of this, you know, enormous dispute with the man who's now been charged with his murder, a property developer, Ron Medich. And he kept saying, you know, I've got all this dirt on Ron Medich, forget about me, because he had been charged with the firebombing of a house at the time.
He was no angel, was he?
No, certainly not. And he kept saying he had this tape. this tape, it's going to bring down the government, I've got this tape. And finally I snapped at him and I said, oh, look, stop telling me about the tape and just give me the tape. You know, I can't do anything, you know, without the tape. You're saying that there's this tape. And he said, you don't understand. There's a hit out on me. I'm going to be murdered. And I didn't say anything at the time, but I hung up the phone. I thought, oh, honestly, these people exaggerate, really.
Because that was my next question. Did you believe him? Did you think drama queen, or did you think he is trying to manipulate me?
Because I thought he was trying to manipulate me, and I thought he was being a drama queen. And then when it actually did happen, I felt a sense of complete remorse and, you know, could I have done anything? I don't think so. But I did speak to the police that night. So within an hour or so of him being murdered, someone had got in touch with me to say that this had happened. So I did pass on, you know, what I knew, because at the same time, we're citizens, we have rights and obligations. Not everything is a story. And I think sometimes journalists get lost in that a little bit.
How has the job changed, Kate? Because you've been doing it a long time.
Look, I think the job has changed in that the access to information now is certainly so much easier. One of the tools most often used by investigative journalism is the Australian Securities and Investments Commission records. These are records that show who is in a company, who their business partners are, what previous businesses they might have had, are they bankrupt, what charges are on their property, meaning have they got large borrowings with banks, etc.
It's good stuff, in other
words. It's great stuff. 20 years ago, you had to go down in person, and it was then the Australian Securities Commission, and you couldn't put in Richard Adie. I couldn't put your name in and say, tell me what you've got. I had to know the names of your companies before I could search them. And I remember doing a story on a corrupt union boss, even back then, and the biggest joy in his life was his greyhounds. So I got a list of his greyhounds from the Greyhound Racing Authority.
Was that difficult, actually? Or
well, it
were
was.
They, yeah, so you
but
had
anyway,
to get those first.
I trot, and there were the greyhounds. They were the names of his company. So I did a little jig in the foyer of the Securities Commission. But now you can sit at your desk and you can do these things. They are costly. And I think that makes investigative journalism almost impossible for others other than those employed by the large organisations. One, doing those kind of searches with ASIC, as I said, are not cheap. We also do real estate data checks. We also have, you know, resources to lawyers. Sometimes during an investigation, I will ring up our lawyers and just run something past them saying, right, if we continue going down this track, do you think it'll be a defamation problem if we pursue this angle or that angle? And then if things do go wrong, you have a major organisation there to support you. I mean, when I say do go wrong, it's more dealing with complaints that come in. People still try to threaten you. Once you write a story, you'll often get a letter saying, you write one more story on this and we will prosecute you not just for defamation but for malice, that you're showing a pattern of going after our client. And those kind of things are intimidating in their own way.
Mm. You're saying, you know, you only can do that because you have the freedom of working at a large organisation. It's a smaller organisation than it was. There's been cutbacks at the Herald and at Fairfax and indeed at all newspapers. And you're hardly resourced like Woodward and Bernstein were or the heyday of the Sunday Times Insight team. Has that made it harder at all?
I think what has made it harder is that there's just not enough of us to do the stories that are there to be done. For instance, I spend quite a bit of my day replying to emails, people call, you know, please, you know, you're my last resort, can you look at X, Y, Z? And it's heartbreaking saying to these people, look, I'm dreadfully sorry, but I just can't. And a lot of time goes through sifting through all these things that come in.
So how many more of you could you do with?
Oh.
or other, because we've mentioned other fine investigative journalists who you've worked with, but obviously, the teams that do this
in all
of our papers are smaller.
I don't think that I have any particular gift. It's not that. It's just that over the years, I think you build up really good contacts who are always helpful. And I must emphasize that you have to behave ethically. There's this thing called burning a source, where if you get a great story that you've given your word that you won't print, if the story is big enough, then, you know, people say burn your source. To me, that is a complete anathema, because I just sort of feel you are as good as your word. And there have been times in the past where I've had a great story and I've gone back to my source and said, please, will you let me use it? And they've said no. And I've stuck to that. And I just sort of think you do need to have a reputation that people can trust you, that if you are called before a court and they ask you to name your source, you will respect the undertaking that you have given.
Would it be possible now for you to spend a month on something and not have anything at the end of it, not have something in the paper? Would that be okay now?
Yes. Look, that does happen, but you tend to be self-regulating because journalists are such fragile creatures. If I haven't had something in the paper for 2 weeks and someone says to me, oh, have you been on holidays? I feel crushed. I feel a failure. I feel, oh. So you do make a call. If you don't think that something is going to develop, you might put it on hold.
Australian investigative journalist Kate McClaymount speaking to Richard Eadie. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Well, before we end off, let's now take a look at what we can expect propagation-wise with our propagation editor, Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation for the week from October 26th to November 1st, 2013. A 10.7 centimeter flux of 115 on October 26th, October 27th and 28th, 110, 105 on October 29th, 100 October 30th and 31st, November 1st, 105. The A index is 5, steady all week long from October 26th to November 1st, and then a stable KP index at 2 from October 26th to November 1st. As the sun continues to be active this week, we hear a lot of noise on the bands. October 22nd brought us a solar tsunami and strong radio burst. The sun is peppered with sunspots 1872 through 1879. 1878 is not seen at this time. No coronal holes this week. We have more radio propagation for you at our website, www.pcjmedia.com/RPROP. Back to you, Keith.
Thanks, Dan. Before we go, if you want to listen to this program again or catch past editions, visit our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. You can also write us to let us know what you think of the show or if you have any story ideas. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. This month, by the way, we have, of course, our monthly edition of the show that some of you will be able to hear on the station you're listening to right now. To find out details of where you can hear it, you can visit the website that I just mentioned. On behalf of the whole team that helped put the program together, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. 73 and 88 to the ladies.
If there's anything that you want, if there's anything I can do, just call on me and I'll send it along with a from me to you. I've got everything that you want, like a heart that's so, so true. Just call on me.